Here's Pyrite Reel 7. As you sort of your time went through out there, what was your attitude to the prospect of demobilisation? Was it something you yearned for or what?
Well, I did yearn for it. I remember some of the guys in the back room literally had, like prisoners do, you know, they had days they crossed off. I remember initially, of course, I couldn't wait to get out of the army, but as I enjoyed life in Malaya more, because I did really enjoy it, and it was a great experience, perhaps I was less counting the days until maybe 2 or 3 months before, when I began to think, hey, you know, I haven't got long now. And I was longing for certain things. I was longing for London, which was, had always been my home and a place I loved, you know, all that sophistication and possibility of theatres and things. I mean, let me say that entertainments, I used to go to the Chinese cinema. I believe there was an occasional, not actually a cinema, but films were occasionally shown in the town, mostly Chinese or Indian films. I would go to those. Don't remember any British films being shown. Theatre, nothing, except there was a review at Christmas, I do remember, in the Naffy, which we all did sketches.
And tell
I did.
Me about that.
Well, the trouble is I can't... I remember the guy playing the piano, I remember a knees up, I remember people dressing as women, which is always a sort of classic thing, isn't it? And I believe I did a sketch of some kind, which was probably impossibly pretentious. It's sort of... I have this dim memory of dressing up and doing a monologue, but what the hell the monologue was, I probably wrote it. And people, I was meant to be funny, I know that, but I just can't remember what it was. But it was sketches, and Jerry, the tall guy, sang Ave Maria and Solo Sole Mio and possibly Nessun Dorma, I can't remember, but you know, all the classics. And somebody probably accompanied him on the piano. And the serious guy, who might or might not have been a chartered accountant later, turned out to be rather amusing too, and did something. I think he dressed... Yes, that's right. I remember him having enormous boobs, so he must have put on some kind of a costume and probably a mop on his head, you know. It was all that sort of stuff. Let your hair down for a night. Although discipline wasn't very, I must say, very tough at any time. It was relaxed.
Now, what about the move towards getting to the end?
Well, as I think it happened like this, that I was due to leave the army in September, almost exactly 2 years, just under 2 years from when I joined, and that I had to get back to Britain the end of August or the beginning of September. And we can actually, in later, I think we can date it, but let me think, I think that's what happened. And I believe I was moved down from the Cameron Highlands something like July, back to Ypres, to the same old camp. And I remember a couple of things there. I remember, yes, this is where I do remember going to church, because I was given the church hall keys, and I used to go in and play the piano in the church hall in the afternoons. And I also remember going to Robinson's, which was one of the big stores. I believe they may still exist. A chain of them, two or three of them anyway. And they served the most delicious English-style sandwiches. I was suddenly beginning to long for the odd bit of English food, and these were soft white bread, probably the worst kind of bread we would think now, but seemed delicious, and butter and slices of ham and things, in a rather sort of posh cafe in Robinson's. So perhaps I was beginning to think, you know, I'm going back, I better start Britishizing myself a bit. And I also remember, in those last days in Ypres, meeting a wonderful man, Dr. Wu Lien-te. Dr. Wu, W-U, his surname, Lien, L-I-E-N-T-E-H. And he had been the doctor who had cured the last wave of bubonic plague in China in about 1910. He's a very old man. And he'd come to retire in Ypres, where he ran a little pharmacy. And he was a sort of famous figure and a scholar. And I can't remember how I got to know him, but I went to see him, and he talked to me about imperial days in China, about Chinese art, which he collected, poetry, which he read and wrote. And that was a sort of lovely glimpse into Chinese life. So those last few days, or weeks or months, no, weeks, I think, in Ypres were very contented, and perhaps I was let off a lot of duties. I must still have had something to do, but I think the feeling was that there wasn't much for me to do.
So that would be, roughly speaking, July to August.
Something like that. That's right.
58.
And then around early August 58, it was a train south to straight to Singapore, I think. Because I remember very clearly the goodbyes on the station. A lot of troops were getting on it, and Graham and I had a number of Chinese, Malay, and Indian friends to see us off, which was thought fairly odd and remarkable, because the other troops, maybe the odd, I don't think any prostitutes came to the station. I can't remember anybody seeing them off, but there were two things that were thought odd by the other troops. I remember one of them saying, one, that they were all locals, and two, that they were all men. It doesn't mean that we only had male relationships, because we got to know families and daughters and sisters and so on, but they were either too modest or I don't know. It was the blokes that came, and people from the police station came, not John Lamb, because he was still up in Cameron Highlands. So there we were being waved off by this gang of locals, and I think the other soldiers thought we were a pair of poofters, you know, without, well, they more or less said that, actually. But we didn't get too badly teased, and we went down south repeating the journey the other way that I'd done 18 months earlier. I think we were in Nee Soon camp again for a very short while and embarked on another ship whose name I've forgotten to do the return voyage round the Cape, because the Suez Canal was still not open. Or am I wrong? Yes, I'm wrong, because I have been through the canal and that must have been the time. So I think, subject to correction, that it was just reopened, and the whole business of the canal, which was fascinating, and the dirty postcards, the other end, and all that stuff.
So this would be August
58. If I'm wrong, I'm remembering another trip I did, because later on in my life I went to Borneo to teach. But then I would have flown, so it must have been. I must have come back through the Suez Canal, and then into the Mediterranean, and coming back, I have a very strong memory of the cold sweeping over us, because although, see, it's odd, I'm talking about August, but still out at sea, it felt cold. And I remember we had a news notice board, bits, clippings from papers, or I don't know what, how they did it those days. They can't deliver the papers, but maybe they were wireless telegraph prints or something. And there were race riots in Notting Hill. So you can date very precisely, and I can't remember now, when that would have been. It was the first big race riots that Britain had had, sort of probably since the murder of the Jews in York in the 12th century, I don't know. And I remember thinking rather, oh God, you know, what country am I going back to? Is it civil war? What's going to happen? In fact, now, you know, it all ended, and touch wood, we've had a few others, but not too bad. And so we came into Liverpool, and I felt very cold, and disembarked, and still in, we were in uniform and got into back into our battle dress, and trained back. And I remember stopping at Woking. I think that I was allowed to go straight home before going back to Maresfield Camp, because that's how I remember it, with my kit bag. And stopping at Woking in the rain and looking out of the window and thinking how ugly English women were, and that I would never marry an English woman. Which, you know, I withdraw totally now. That was just a feeling. But I didn't marry an English woman. I married a girl from Penang, who I hadn't met while I was there, but when she came over here, we had much in common, so that started the connection. And so to London, and home, and an amazing homecoming. I remember turning the corner, just before I turned the corner into my street, I thought of Jane Eyre, and Jane going back, and the house had been burnt down. You know, the sort of stupid things you think of, will it still be there? And it was. And then I went to Maresfield for a very brief while, handed in my army stuff, was given a terrible civilian suit. They were still doing that in those days. It was a sort of rusty brown and very hairy. What I did with it, I don't know. All the army kit was handed over, though I had a funny feeling I was allowed to keep some things. I can't remember what it was. I did get a little strip of metal and a medal, you know, a badge, what you call it, a braiding, for the Malayan emergency, which counted as active service, which, as I remember, is green and purple. Somewhere I have it. And that, I think, was it.
Now, how did you get back? We're quite interested in how fluently people get back into their civilian life. Now, you'd already got your place of...
I got my place at Christchurch, Oxford, and I don't remember there being any jarring that, well, there's one point. As far as getting back to being a civilian, that was sheer delight. I mean, little things one forgets about, that even though I'd worn civilian clothes a lot of the time, and I'd had Adobe, somebody to do the washing, the softness of shirts, the luxury of sheets, the comfort of carpets, all these things which I had, as a child, assumed and taken for granted, and I hadn't had for a long time, I got them. And that was fantastic. And the luxury of getting up when you liked and so on, and the pleasure of London, and the trips with my mother to look at London, and theatres, and ballet, and cinema, and friends, and, you know, all that fairly comfortable middle-class life and the excitement of a metropolis, I fell back into absolutely fine. But what I do remember is feeling oddly unfitted to go to university, which is strange, because you might think that I would have grown up and, you know, be more mature than people who come straight from school. But I felt intellectually very much as if I'd gone back several hundred yards. And it wasn't that I hadn't read or thought while abroad, but I hadn't had that scholastic rhythm which you do at some degree have at sixth form in school. And so suddenly I found myself with people who I thought were a lot cleverer than I was, and quite often younger than me, and a feeling of dislocation and inferiority, which took me quite a while to recover from. I mean, it may just have been I didn't feel as clever as a lot of them and would have felt that anyway.
You went to?
To Oxford to read modern history at Christchurch, which is an interesting college, in as much as in those days it was still fairly patrician, though it did have grammar school boys coming in. And I suppose I found it odd to be back with the officer class again, having really not lived with the officer class for nearly 2 years.
Did you find students silly?
Yes, that's a good point. Funny enough, I don't remember thinking that. I didn't feel in any way superior to them. I felt intellectually... And you see, because I hadn't grown up sexually or anything very much, I was rather backward in that way. I didn't feel like a man of the world who could tell them a tale or two about, you know, sexual experiences in the Far East, because I hadn't done any of that. So I didn't feel they were silly. I mean, I'd always thought people getting drunk and breaking bottles, whether it was in the army or anywhere, was a bit of a waste of time. Quite a serious guy, I suppose. One thing that had been nourished or nourishing inside me was the love of and the desire to acting. And all I'd done in the army was possibly that naffy concert and so on. But I did get seriously stuck into drama at Oxford and did more drama than work, really. And that was picking up on something I'd been very keen on as a boy and into my late teens at school.
So what career did you go to pursue after? Could you just sort of give
Absolutely. Well, did 3 years at Oxford, got a respectable 2-1. During my time there, a lot of acting, and I thought I was going to be an actor. I also went on some wonderful trips with groups of friends, the most spectacular of which was my last year, last free summer, 1960, when I went with eight of us, took a Land Rover, and we drove to Damascus through everything you would cross to get to Damascus, and made a study of Crusader castles in the Turkish mountains, where T.E. Lawrence, Lawrence of Arabia, had been a long time before and written his thesis on. So that was a sort of historical revisiting, plus fun, plus first glimpse of the Middle East, plus first glimpse of Turkey, plus first time out of Europe in one sense. Of course, I'd been to the Far East, but, you know, actually crossing the place and seeing how it worked and so on. And that was a wonderful and amazing experience. And a little book came out of that, which I've gotten lost. It was really privately printed, but we did do something. So that's been good, the holidays. I went to Sicily on another trip. I went to Greece on another. I was falling in love with European culture and really forgot the Far East except for this little calligraphy I still went on doing, and the love of the look of the people was still in my mind. So my jobs afterwards, having leaving Oxford in summer 61, and that rather leisurely early 60s when it didn't seem terribly important to get a job. You sort of felt it would fall into your hands. I do remember that a group of top brass from the BBC came down to Oxford recruiting, probably early summer 61 or something like that, or maybe even 60. People like Stuart Hood, you know, who was then a big controller. He then later left the BBC. And we all had sherry in the Oxford Union. When I say all, people who'd been prominent either in drama or debating or politics or something, because they were looking for recruits as general trainees or whatever. So I did apply to the BBC as a general trainee, and I got through a couple of boards, and then they didn't think I was right. Quite right, too. My exact contemporary and still great friend, Melvin Bragg, that was how he got in, exactly at such a recruiting system, and he did get a general traineeship, and the rest, as they say, is history. But in my case, no, they didn't want me, so I went and worked for the Bishop of Borneo. Again, you know, I said to the Far East I'd forgotten. Well, I obviously hadn't, because I found this out, because of my sort of vaguely religious leaning, somehow I'd learnt that the Bishop of Borneo was looking for volunteer teachers for no salary but their keep and accommodation and little pocket money. And so in the beginning of 1962, yeah, that's right, I went off, or perhaps the end of 61, can't quite remember whether I was there for Christmas in England or not, off to Borneo via Singapore again, didn't stop in Malaysia this time, and to Kuching, Sarawak, where I worked for a year and a bit, so I completely missed the end of the world with the Cuban crisis. I didn't even know that happened. Did a lot of jungle exploring and going up country to visit pupils. Got to know the Dayaks very well. Lived in longhouses. My Malay was still vaguely useful. Worked as a freelance disc jockey on Radio Sarawak in the evenings, putting on my own discs. You know, and I shouldn't think the audience was very big, because once when I was putting on something from Transcription Service, I put completely wrong disc on, so we changed from a programme of Scottish poetry into a discussion of Central European politics, and no one ever even rang up to complain. So it shows the audience was small. I met Tom Harrison, the amazing curator of the Sarawak Museum, who was one of the great maverick figures, had been in the Force 136 in the jungle during the war, had parachuted in, had invented mass observation with another guy whose name I've forgotten, but it was the first real study of what the ordinary man and woman in Britain thought in the 30s. He was a great figure, later to be tragically killed in a bus accident. That wasn't while I was there. And I taught anything from football to physics. You know, it didn't care whether you knew anything about it or not, you just taught it. And came back in 63, late 63, met and fell in love with the girl I was going to marry, who was Chinese from Penang and was doing her MPhil in London University. And joined the British Council at the same time, having looked for other jobs, the fact that I taught abroad, that I knew a bit about teaching, got me into the British Council, where they made me into a television and radio officer. That's to say, I learned how to use television and radio to teach English. And fairly shortly, before I could get married, leaving my future wife behind, I went off to Khartoum, the Sudan, in March or February 1964, where I started up a school's television and radio service, believe it or not. And the government kept changing, so you just go around briefing all the ministers, and then there'll be a revolution, you have to brief a new lot. But anyway, the service staggered on, and came home in September 64, September 25th, I got married to my wife. We're still married, and we have one child born in Khartoum. Came back from Khartoum at the end of 67, thinking we can't go wandering however nicely for the British Council for the rest of our lives, and applied again to the BBC, and this time got in World Service, teaching English by radio. From there into drama department, from there into documentaries and features, and the rest of my working life, until I retired in December 97, was there. I never went back to Malaya, except in 76 as a husband. Sorry, twice. Went back in 65 as a husband to Penang to meet my in-laws, and went back in 76 as very much a husband with two kids to see all the family. By that time, my father-in-law was dead, but mother-in-law and all the rest. And enjoyed it, and was also collecting material for a BBC programme on China and Chinese habits and customs. And haven't been back since. So next year, 2003, I hope to go back to places that I haven't seen in some cases for 46 years.
Thank you very much.